Progressive Radio Network.
Everybody, I am Karen Hartglass. You are listening to my show. It's called It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me today. Today we are going to be talking about food and specifically the meat question. Now, this is Thanksgiving week and many people across the country will be sitting down at a table with their family and friends. And very often there's a centerpiece, the dead bird. And many of us struggle with this, especially those who eschew meat. And it's really a challenging time. The meat question is very complicated. And I learned a lot from reading a new book about the depth of this question, more than I had ever thought about before. And as you know, I've been reading about food for decades and talking about it for almost as long. And I want to bring on the author of the book, The Meat Question, Animals, Humans, and the Deep History of Food, Josh Burson. We're going to be talking about this book. Josh is an independent social scientist. He has held research appointments at the Berggruen Institute and the Max Planck Institute for Human Cognitive and Brain Sciences, among other places. He's the author of Computable Bodies, Instrumented Life, and the Human Somatic Niche. Josh, welcome to It's All About Food.
Lovely to be here. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you. So as I was mentioning, I've been a vegan for over three decades, and I've read a lot about the whys and hows. And You've come up with a new book, The Meat Question, and there was a lot of interesting and new information in it. I hadn't seen this discussion around meat discussed exactly in this way before, and so I appreciate the book for that reason. It's a very dense book, and there's a lot of things in here, and I know that we can't possibly touch on all of them in a half hour.
Sure.
And it took me a long time to read this book. I have to confess, I'm a very fast reader, and there was a lot of vocabulary in here that gave me pause, because we're talking about paleontology and anthropology and physiology, and I can't even pronounce all the ologies, but there's a lot of vocabulary that comes with each of them. So in the beginning of, let's just talk about the meat question. Actually, there's more than one question in this book, but why did you write this book? And what is the specific meat questions?
So there are a couple of origin stories I can tell about this book or book in the past, but the one that feels appropriate here is a rather a personal one. So kept a vegan, or I guess today more and more people are saying plant-based diet for years. And I was I've been a vegetarian for about 25 years. And when I'd been keeping an animal-free diet and in other ways trying to abjure the use of animals, for about 10 years, I started wondering if it was still a meaningful practice for me, if it was still a meaningful thing for me to do, a meaningful way for me to be a conscientious citizen, or to express, to maintain a conscientious attitude toward other human beings, toward animals, and toward our shared environment. And around that time, I'd been working for some time on a series of projects in the history of anthropology in Australia, and I became aware of I'd become aware of the role that the livestock industry played in the colonization of the dry lands in, of all of Australia, but in particular the dry lands of the interior and northwest of Australia, and of the role that the livestock industry played in the transformation of the lives of the people who had been living there, who are sort of iconic foragers, right? These are often we think of, well, or the first generation of behavioral ecologists, of people who, of anthropologists and biologists, who applied a behavioral lens, an ecological lens to the description of human behavior, starting in the 1950s, saw the foragers of Australia as sort of a template for what's become known as Man the Hunter. So there was a conference held at the University of Chicago in 1966 on the theme of Man the Hunter. And the organizers admit in the introduction to the edited volume that emerged from this, this symposium that hunting is really not the most apposite way to describe the strategy for getting a living that the people, that the communities they were discussing follow. That by and large, most of the diet, in most cases, with the exception of the of people in the far north and the circumpolar region, was vegetarian. And yet, they felt compelled to center their discussion on hunting. Hunting seemed emblematic of human behavior, and that continues to be the case. So I observed that here was a colonized population that was regarded widely, both popularly and scholarly, as a meat eating community, and yet their meat consumption shot up dramatically once they became enrolled in the livestock economy. And so this seemed to offer a little parable, you know, a story I could tell that sort of challenged our going assumptions about the relationship between the intensification of livestock production and the intensification of demand for meat. In other words, we expect that the demand is driving the intensification of production, and yet in this case, it seemed to be the other way around, that production was driving demand, or at least consumption. And so I thought this would end by writing this little book as a parable. At that point, I had in mind like a very short book, maybe a third of the length of the book that I ended up writing. I could work out some of my own questions about whether this was still a meaningful thing for me to do, whether I still had good reasons or had new good reasons for keeping a vegan diet and in other ways of avoiding the use of animals. And that was around 2011. And it took me a while because I struggled with not only with the scope of the problem. As you say, this is a dense book, and I've done my best to leaven it and to make it accessible. But inevitably, it's a dense topic. But I wanted to show, and one of the other origin stories of this book is the growing popularity of popular works of big history, right? Exemplified, say, by the work of Jared Diamond. And so I saw there was a market for that there was interest among readers in reading about how humanity has changed over long spans of time. But I wanted to offer a different way of looking at that history, of thinking about history over long periods of time, of showing that a less deterministic way, of showing just how much contingency is at play, just how much uncertainty in the evidence that we bring to bear on questions about what people were eating 50 or 100,000 or a million years ago. And between those two desires, you know, to work out my own relationship to animals and to to model a more open-ended way of looking at the deep history of humanity. It took me quite a while, but that's where the book came from. And I'd be glad to talk about, you know, how my argument evolved.
Okay. So we're talking about the first third of the book or so. You go back very, very far into history. And just today, in 2019, it's really hard to know what's true anymore. We have fake news. So many people are believing so many different things. People don't want to believe what they hear. It's just crazy. And this is the present. And you give this beautiful analogy in the beginning of the book about how being on a beach one day and how quickly all the evidence of what was there is gone, like the next day. And so going back in time, 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, 1,000,000 years, how do we even talk about that time and know that any of it's
true?
How
do we? Right. Or rather, or even more to the point, how can we say that there was one thing happening at that time, that there was a Paleolithic diet, or that there was one economic strategy that that humans or if going back, you know, 1,000,000 years, say earlier hominins were following, that they were following that same strategy in every part of the world where they were found, because already they were widely dispersed by that time. So how can we make such determinate statements about the deep history of human beings in any regard, in particular in this case, their relationship to other large vertebrates, when we can't even agree, you know, to take an example from the front page of today's paper that climate change is happening, right? So I do spend a big part of the first third of the book talking about standards of evidence in paleontology and zooarchaeology, the archaeology of animal-human relationships. And I do this not, I want to be clear that my goal is not to make people skeptical of the science. I think the science is often very strong, but what I want, my aim, to put it in the most practical terms, is the next time, if you read this book, then the next time you read it, you know, in the news, in the science news, right, about claims about what some community of human beings were doing at some distant point in the past. Right. I want people to have the tools to ask, well, what kind of evidence were these researchers bringing to bear? Right? How big was the sample? Right? What are the alternate hypotheses, the alternate interpretations of this evidence? Right. I wanted people to start to think more critically about the stories we tell about our deep past, because these stories shape how we think about our future, right? If we think that eating animals was the central fact in how human beings came to colonize such a vast range of environments around the world, right, in a way that's different from how other primates or other large vertebrates have done, then it becomes more difficult to imagine a future in which we no longer consume animals, if we think that was somehow essential to our becoming what we are, right? But if we can learn to see, to view the evidence that we have in a more open-ended way, see the plurality of not to say that the evidence is that interpretation is unconstrained by evidence, not to say that we're free to imagine whatever set of alternative facts or alternative histories we like, but just to bear in mind, you know, that uh, that that when we look at a set of facts, we're always bringing an interpretive lens to it that comes from our past, right? And it's a struggle to break out of that lens, to view the same facts in a new light. So that's a big part of what I'm doing in the thought experiment you allude to at the beginning of chapter one, A Day at the Beach, and over the course of the first half of the book. I'm showing that there's a richer way to think about the past. And in fact, at one point in the third chapter, I say, and I'm not going to name any names, but we're sort of drawn to stories of humanity's rising from coming back from the brink of extinction, of recovering from a population bottleneck, of moments when we almost didn't make it, and then we triumphed, we rose and vanquished all the other kinds of late hominins, right, to become and assume the crown, right? as we kind of impose this teleological lens, this goal-directed lens on history, and you find this lens commonly in books for non-specialists about the deep past. And so, what I want to encourage my readers to do is to break out of that lens, to adopt a richer, more textured view of the past. And that's challenging. You know, we're drawn to cognitive. We all have a desire for cognitive closure, and I'm insisting that we turn away from that desire, that we maintain skepticism, toward our own views, and that's not an easy sell.
It's not easy, and this idea of critical thinking, it applies to all science, and it applies to current thinking today too. We see so many studies that come out, and people will just see the headline and say, "Oh, that's it," and start sharing it and repeating it without even knowing what happened in the study, who was involved in paying for it, what the sample size was, so many different parameters to know if the information was had any value. And then you add to that going back so far where you can't duplicate your experiments. But right. This idea of critical thinking is so important. And I remember you talked a bit about foraging, for example. You mentioned it in the beginning of the program. Yeah. The way we perceive foraging today is based on current Aboriginal cultures that are with us today who are nothing like, or I mean, we can only assume they were not like what they are today, because the parameters have changed today in so many ways that these people are responding to the changes.
And I want to emphasize that it's not that we can't know anything securely about the past. I mean, I make plenty of assertions about the past and about the deep past in this book, and I make them with the idea in mind that my readers will go along with them, right? At least for the time that they're with me. But yes, with respect to foraging, well, there are a couple things going on. One is that I'm careful to prioritize the term foraging as opposed, say, to hunting and gathering, except when hunting or gathering is the more appropriate, the more specific term, because I'm trying to I'm trying to show that maybe it wasn't all hunting, or maybe hunting was not even the most salient dimension of the food quest among the people who are the reference of our fantasies about our own deep past. The other thing is that yes, we have to be very careful about what anthropologists and philosophers of science would call ethnographic analogies, about taking people who get their living by foraging today as stand and using them as stand-ins for the behavior of humans who lived, say, 50 or 100,000 years ago. It is certainly possible to identify trends or commonalities or consistencies, continuities over very deep stretches of time, but you have to do it very, very carefully. You know, that's again part of what I'm trying to do in the first half of the book is to model a more cautious, but ultimately I feel more exciting way of looking at the past. And at the same time, it's important, you know, it's important to not place these people in a kind of temporal bubble, you know, not to imagine them as living in some kind of eternal ethnographic present that has been unchanging for the past however many tens or hundreds of generations, but in particular to look at how they have fared for good and mostly for ill in our own world and how in many cases people who inhabit food growing societies have benefited from the dispossessions of foraging peoples. So, and that's part of what I do in the second half of the book, where I use the story of the colonization of Australia as one, and of North America, incidentally. I tell this two stories in parallel as set pieces to lay the foundation for consideration of the relationship between meat production and precariousness or poverty in our own world, right? In other words, the premise of the book is that there are two conjoined bits of conventional wisdom about meat eating that make it difficult to imagine a future that is radically different from what we've known in the past. On the one hand, people tend to assume, we were hunters at dawn. Meat made us human. On the other hand, yeah, people, today, you hear a lot, it's fine and good to say that for environmental reasons, ethical reasons, whatever, we need to eat less meat, or we need to stop eating meat, or we need to change our relationship with other than human animals. But the fact of the matter is, in a world of rising cash incomes, growing demand for meat is inevitable. And then you ask why? Well, meat is income elastic. There is an intrinsic demand elasticity for meat. When people's incomes go up, one of the first things they spend their new disposable income on is meat. So if you ask, well, why is that? Well, because we have an innate preference for a meat-rich diet. So these two assertions go hand in hand. And the book aspires to take them apart, one and then the other, to show that yes, there may be an elasticity type relationship between meat and income in the modern world, but there's something else going on. There's also a relationship between meat and economic insecurity. If anything, cheap meat is propping up the precariousness of emerging urban environments. And so, there's not one thing going on, but ultimately where I come out at the end of the book is with the view that really what the meat question is about, to get back to your initial question, is about economic violence, right? It's about how humans and other than human animals occupy coordinate roles of subjection in a single system of economic violence. And often, when we look for solutions, we pit them against one another. Either we say we're going to we're 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 going to prioritize the rights of human beings and treat with skepticism claims for the rights of other than human beings. Or we say we're going to prioritize the rights of other than human beings. We don't say, but we act in a way that indicates we're prioritizing the rights of other than human animals. And in the course of doing that, we end up casting aspersions on human beings who are constrained by their economic position and other factors to subsist today on an animal-rich diet. And so
I just want to underline, making sure people heard what you said. Economic violence. This is like the foundation here. Our capitalistic system today, it is complex and violent.
Well, yeah, I'm right. And it's, there are a large number of moving pieces here, and we don't have the time.
And it's very complex. We have agricultural derivatives.
I don't have the mental wherewithal to go into them all. I mean, it's like, you know, once you write a book like this, you look back and you say, how did I do that? There really is a lot of information to keep track of, and that's why inevitably, despite my best efforts, the book is a bit dense. So certainly in the last third, I make an effort to lighten it up. But
you can make an effort to lighten it up. I mean, there are plenty of wonderful things that are going on today in the world, but it is overwhelming to know what we have done in such a short period of time to affect the planet in so many negative ways, the environment and people and hunger and population, just so many things. But before we go, perhaps you can give us some light. Is that possible?
Sure. Yeah, it's now coming up on 3 years since I finished the first draft of the book. That was at the end of January 2017, and the week I was finishing it was the week of the first constitutional crisis of our current glorious administration over the ban on immigration from Muslim majority countries. And I really wanted in this book to offer a hopeful conclusion. And I really struggled against instinct to do that. But ultimately what it comes down to is that, biology, to the extent that biology is destiny, it does not mean, in the case of human beings, that we are constrained, that we are destined to keep a particular kind of diet. If anything, what has served us best, what has allowed us to proliferate, is our versatility and our ability to fashion new niches in different times and places. Right, and you see this today in other dimensions of human life. No one frets. You know, when people talk about how are we going to provide meat for a world of 10 billion people, no one's fretting about how we're going to transform our big cities into the savannas of the Great Rift Valley 2 million years ago. Right, we've adapted to a new kind of environment. So it is our versatility and our capacity for radical transformation of our own behavioral niche that has served us so well in the past, whether it's by allowing us to form cooperative breeding units or to domesticate other living things or to adapt to urban living, right? So certainly it is within our power, within our behavioral range to move past a time when meat was an essential component of our diet. And that's where I end the book, and that's where I'll end with you. That it's not if humanity survives another 100 years, I think there's a good chance that eating meat will be practically unheard of then.
All right. Well, we'll leave it at that, and maybe who knows? Maybe we'll be able to see that turnaround in our lifetime. We'll see.
Maybe.
Yeah. Thank you for joining me today and for writing The Meat Question, Animals, Humans, and the Deep History of Food. I really appreciate it. Thank you.